Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do a review, stick it up here on the podcast feed, everyone can download it, that's the way it works. So, I don't think I've got any news, but thanks for all of the feedback that I've got recently. Lots of people have been emailing me in, and a few people, when I reply to them, say, wow, I wasn't expecting a reply to the email, but I do. I reply to every single email that I receive. So if you want to chat, or if you want passing along some feedback, or if you want to recommend a book or anything like that, if you want to talk politics, as long as you're not too much of a hardcore libertarian, I will entertain a conversation with you as well. I really enjoy that kind of stuff. So email me, luke@juggler.net. My other podcast project, which is Luke's Creative Podcast, seems to be going quite well, getting a bit of feedback from that as well. Lots of interviews and discussions and talks with generally creative people about creative topics. Very eclectic show, though. I talk about lots of different subjects. Hopefully some people can check that out and enjoy it. You can find that at lukeburridge.com/creative and check out the episodes there as well. Season 1 is almost come to an end after 8 weeks now I've been doing it, so another few episodes and that'll finish up too. And then I'll start collecting interviews and discussions and topics for Season 2. So, on to today's episode. I'm going to be reviewing the book called Children of Men by P.D. James. Now, I don't know why I suddenly got a massive spate of emails and messages and Skype messages and Goodreads.com messages saying P.D. James is a woman. Did I mention that I was reading the book and mention that he wrote it? Or maybe I called P.D. James a him instead of a her or something like that. But of course, P.D. James is a woman. I didn't know that and hadn't really thought about it. Just P.D. James. Yeah, whatever. Just an author. And because like 90% of the books that I have read and reviewed for this podcast have been by men, I just presume men. I guess, you know, I don't want to be sexist about this, but it seems that there is way more science fiction authors out there who are guys than there are girls. So I just was a bit too presumptuous. Anyway, so the book is Children of Men, published in 1992, 256 pages long, according to Goodreads.com, which worked out to around about a 10-hour audiobook that I got from Audible, narrated by, I think his name was Julian Glover. And the reason I read this book was mainly because a movie came out, and I watched the movie, and I thought it was very good. I knew it was based on the book, and at the time I was thinking, I'm sure this feels very, very familiar. I think I might have read the book before, but I hadn't read the book, so I thought I would actually just get it there. It came up on Audible as one of the picks or one of the recent releases or something, so I got it. And I might as well say a little bit about the movie. I don't normally talk about this. I mean, I got an email from someone before saying, oh, and this book that you reviewed was made into a computer game, and this one was made into a movie. Why don't you talk about the movie, or why don't you talk about the comic book adaptation and things like that? I don't normally talk about that kind of thing because I see these things as very, very different. Like, if there's a movie version of a book, I never think of it, oh, they ruined the book by making a movie of it. And if there's another movie version of another movie, I never think, oh, why are they remaking this? They've spoiled it. Because I see every different iteration of a story in a different media, or even in the same media, to be completely separate. I don't care about them remaking the Poseidon Adventure as Poseidon. You know, one movie still exists, they make another movie. The original movie still exists, and they can tell different stories with different characters and things like that. In this case, because I read the book because of the movie, I just want to say the movie was probably one of my favourite science fiction movies of recent years, just because the world is so compelling. And the story isn't that great, but the filmmaking itself, I think, is really, really great. And there were some very interesting ideas in the movie. For example, there's lots of big action sequences, and the main character, who shares the name of the main character in the book, Theo, he in the movie, he goes throughout this whole action movie, and there's massive action set pieces with explosions and gun battles and stuff, and he never once picks up a gun or uses a gun, and I really quite enjoy that. That's very different from the book, but yeah, it just does some interesting things with movie making and with movie conventions that you don't really expect in a big, you know, blockbuster movie. Well, I guess it wasn't a blockbuster movie. It wasn't a big budget movie, I don't think. I'm not sure how successful it was, but it certainly moved me. So let's just get onto the book then, leaving behind the movie, although I might compare and contrast a little bit, but I'll try not to do that, because the movie and the book are completely different. They're set at around about the same time. In the world of the book, it's set in 2021, and the big idea behind this is that 1995, which is just a few years after this book was written in 1992, that was called Omega Year. And Omega Year... Omega Year is the year where suddenly all men become infertile and across the whole world, and no more kids are born, no more children are born, no more babies or anything like that. It's a very simple idea, a very basic idea, and the story actually opens with the youngest man on Earth dying, and he's like 25 at this point, or no, roughly 25, 26, and he dies in a fight in a bar, I think down in South America somewhere in Brazil, I can't remember exactly. And then there is a new youngest person on Earth taking his place. A very powerful idea of a world which is slowly dying. Everyone is growing older, and there's no sound of young children playing in this street. And then the schools close down, and then this closes down, and then the other things close down. And it gets to the point where the universities are only open for like mature students, and they're slowly... closing down. All of the action in the book is set in England, the way that England is holding out against the bleak future, the lack of future, is a guy called Zan. I can't remember his second name, but Zan is was the Prime Minister at one point when he won the election. He said, well, I'm not going to call myself the Prime Minister, I'm going to call myself the Warden of England. And he sets himself up as some kind of benevolent dictator, and then there's the Council of England who are sort of his four advisors. So there's the five advisors, the five councillors of England are running the place, and you know, Parliament is you know, they're not doing very much at all. I think there is still a Parliament, but it's you know, democracy doesn't really have any meaning, because all of the most powerful politicians, or anyone with any power, is just appointed by the Council of England and the Warden of England. As old people are dying, the country is slowly winding things up. One of the main themes of the book is, well, not one of the main themes, but one of the main ideas that they have is the consolidation of population into more central places. So instead of, okay, everyone's living out in the villages and out in the country and things, so you can't do that. Everyone moves to the city so we can better and more efficiently care for old people as they start growing older, and we don't have to worry about supplying power to all of the outlying villages and towns. Move everyone into the cities, and that's a good thing. Another way of helping to look after the old people is by bringing in foreigners, is by bringing in the Omega generation, the last generation of kids who are now adults. Bring them in from abroad, from France and Spain, or from... it never actually says where these foreigners are coming in from, and they call them sojourners or sojourners, and they come in and they can stick around in the country, stick around in England or in the UK, and help everyone out. And then when they turn 60, if anyone turns 60, they are then forcibly sent back home, so they're not allowed to, you know, hang out anymore. And use up the resources for the old people of England. Another thing is, when people grow old, there's this kind of ceremony that they go through called the quietus, or quietus. It's spelt, I guess, quiet us. That's the way it's put in the movie, but they call it quietus. But I like the idea of it's called quiet us. And so quietly, old people go to their deaths in these sort of euthanasia ceremonies where they all get together and hold hands and drown. And so that's an interesting little take on the idea of, you know, of getting rid of the old people, so they're not a burden on society, but they do it voluntarily. And voluntarily is maybe in scare quotes there. Another thing that's going on in the country is the Isle of Wight penal colony, with the idea being that, okay, we can't deal with all these criminals, so if anyone does even something even slightly criminal, slightly violent, if they do any kind of looting or stealing or anything like that, they get like a second chance, and then they get sent to the Isle of Wight penal colony. And there's no prison guards there except around the edge of it. You know, they're keeping track and making sure nobody escapes from the island. But otherwise, it's just, you know, you hear some stories from the Isle of Wight penal colony, and it doesn't sound like a good place. Yeah, so that's the kind of thing that's going on. Now, I just want to mention that the starkest contrast between this book and the movie is that they're both kind of dystopian views of the future. But in the movie, it's like everything is falling into anarchy, and England is only surviving as a society through this very strong fascist dictatorship with a lot of violence towards people and also it seems very busy. It seems like everyone is trying to get into the country. That the one of the main themes of the movie is that that the entire world has completely fallen into anarchy except England. So everyone is trying to make their way to England and force their way in, and sort of there's almost an invasion of foreigners coming into England, and the dictatorship and all of the military and police and everything like that are all trying to get rid of them and trying to move them out, or you know, just whatever, just get rid of them. And so it feels quite, in the movie, it felt quite crowded. You know, there's scenes of London and lots of stuff was happening, and they go out into the country and there's people everywhere, and they go here and there, and there's just lots of people and the whole thing is sort of like falling apart. Whereas in the book, it seems that like it's quite the opposite. You know, it's still a dystopian view of the future, but it seems like everyone is just happy to get on with slowly dying. And the rest of the world seems to be, you know, have the same fate. Everyone is just sort of hanging out and just waiting for everything you know, not really fall apart. Like in the movie, everything is falling apart and breaking down. Whereas in the book, everything is just sort of slowly closing down, in a quite controlled manner. And people seem to be happy to do less and less, rather than being forced to do nothing or forced to do something. They just seem to be happy to just go, oh, okay, well, we'll just quietly do less and quietly just get on with life and things like that. So what happens is in the book, when people try to shake things up, they try to get society moving again. I kind of felt like sorry for the ordinary people in the book. Our main character does too. He's like, hey, what? Everyone's just trying to live in peace and quiet. You know, they want to distract themselves from the end of the world and the end of humanity, so why don't you just let everyone relax? Whereas in the book, it seems like the opposite. It's like instead of trying to shake things up, the you know, the revolutionaries in the movie are trying to sort of quieten things down and trying to make, you know, life more bearable. Whereas in the book, it's the other way around. Like I say, it's sort of like the people are trying to shake things up rather than you know, and trying to get people moving again in the world. And it's really strange. I think I'm more used to seeing the kind of dystopian visions of the future that are in the movie, because where everyone is like, you know, everyone's rushing about and there's lots of violence and everything. And, you know, you're kind of used to that. Whereas in the book, it must be quite good writing, because I sort of found myself, like, admitting that the Warden of England is sort of doing the right thing. Or maybe not the right thing, but he's got the right intentions. Maybe, of course, you know, the different... the different ends justifying the means that he's going to you know, to keep everything in line and to make everyone happy. But the idea of just going, okay, no, everyone should just be happy to slowly, you know, to slowly fade away and let humanity slowly fade away as more and more people die and nobody else is born. I actually, you know, that's quite appealing. I understand that. And I think it might be because it's a well-written book that you can just accept that. I'm not sure how realistic it would be. I think there would be like more anarchy and more trouble, but otherwise, you know, as portrayed in the book, it's a very sort of like, okay, very middle class kind of existence, and everyone's just getting on with it. So moving on to the story, Theo, let me just, I have the Wikipedia page here. I'll get his full name. So it says his name is Theo, I can't find it. Theo Farron, that's it. So Theodore, Dr. Theodore Theo Farron. He is an Oxford University history professor, and the only remarkable thing about him, really, is that he is the cousin of the Warden of England. And that's the only thing that's really notable in his life to anybody else. And he is just getting on with life. At one point, he was on a sort of like an advisory role to the Council of England, because his cousin, the warden, said, "Hey, I need a bit of help." And he did that for a while, but it became disillusioned because, you know, his views weren't really being listened to, and he felt like he was a bit ineffectual. So then he goes back to being a historian and teaching mature students at Oxford University and just getting on with life. And he likes drinking wine and he likes writing. He starts writing a diary. And he's contacted by an ex-student who is part of the group, this kind of small group of revolutionaries called the Five Fishes, and they want to shake things up a bit. They don't like the penal colony, and they don't like the laws about everyone being, you know, the fertility testing, and they don't like the way that sojourners are being treated, and they don't like the quietus. And there's a few different things that they want to change about it. And so they get, one of them gets in contact with Theo and invites him to one of their meetings, and he goes and talks to them. And so at their request, he finds out a bit more about the quietus and these other issues, and he agrees on their behalf to talk with the council, not to talk with the Council of England, but to go and talk with his cousin, even though he's saying, "Look, my cousin never listens to me. My cousin has never listened to me. He's his own man. I'm my own man. And I don't, you know, me going to talk with my cousin probably isn't going to help at all." He said, in fact, he says, it's probably not going to help. He says, "It certainly won't help. I know it's not going to help." But in the end, he decides to anyway. And of course, he goes to talk with his cousin and ends up talking to the rest of the council as well, and gets no response, which is a real pity. But then, of course, later on in the book, or sort of in book two, there's two parts of the book. Part one of this book, or book one, is called Omega, and the other one is called Alpha. So in Alpha, he later gets sucked back in to the group of the Five Fishes in a slightly more active role, as they also ramp up their sort of their sedition, their subterfuge, their revolutionary ideas and things like that. And there are really no major twists. There's only sort of like one surprising turn of events along the way, which I don't want to spoil here. And in fact, the story is in total very very sedate. You know, later on in the book, there's chases and shootings and, you know, plenty of action. But it happens at this, like I say, this very kind of sedate, like middle class countryside pace. You know, when they go and do stuff, it's like, "Oh, okay, well, let's," like the conspirators, they're all like, "Hey, let's meet in this church here. Do you know this church?" "Yes, we're going to meet a church. We're going to pretend that we're into choral singing." And then, "Oh, that's great. So we'll pretend we're choral singers." And then when they pass messages between them, they don't, you know, they do it via, "Oh, let's go to this museum and I'll leave a note for you in this museum." And they all live in Oxford, or they don't all live there, but, you know, they sort of hang out in Oxford and they want to do things, and it's actually quite strange. But it makes for the pacing of the book to be very slow, certainly in the first half. It feels like nothing is happening for a long time. But the pacing kind of works in this, like, okay, nothing is really that crucial. We can just hang around, you know, we don't need to worry too much about it. You know, at one point, Theo is just like, "Nah, well, I'll do what you want, but, you know, not next week, not the week after, but the week after that, I'll get back to you. Oh, and now I'm just going to go on holiday, you know, go on a vacation for 4 or 5 months or something." But that lets us get plenty of character development, especially of our protagonist, as Theo. He talks a lot about his past life and his diary and all the kind of things that he has experienced with his cousin well before Omega year, or Year Omega, when they were growing up as well. And then at the ending, I found the ending satisfying. Some of the choices that the characters made, I was like, what's going on here? But it's quite abrupt, but it does make quite a bit of sense, I think. There is hope, and there's hints at, like, vast struggles ahead. And I found the acceptance of some of the characters, you know, to the very ending to be a bit surprising. But then I thought about it, because it was a while ago that I finished this book, and I sort of see what the author, James, is doing here. The new era kind of calls for new ideas and new ideals and new leaders and things like that. The story isn't great, and I think actually it's not as good as the idea of the book could be. That, you know, the story execution based on the idea could have been better, but it's good enough, let me put it that way. Moving on to the characters of the book. So, our main character, Theo, Theo Farren. He is a historian, as I said, and he is someone who most people think is a little bit boring. And the only thing going for him is that he's the cousin to the Warden of England, and he really is boring. And he's happy to be so. He's like, okay, I'm just going to do this. I'm just going to live my life. And his cousin, Zan, is like, yeah, all you'll do is you'll grow up, you'll do well at university, you'll get married to someone pretty who you meet at university, you'll become a professor, and then you'll just live out your life. You know, and Zan's pretty much says what his life is going to be like before it happens. And he's like, yeah, that'll be my life, and that'll be all that happens, you know. And he seems to be very happy just to be the boring history professor who also teaches a little bit of literature and things like that. But then again, I did find his backstory quite compelling. I really enjoyed reading his, you know, because a part of the story is written in diary form, and he talks quite a bit about growing up with Zan, and I found that quite interesting. You know, the real, you know, he's all the time he's comparing himself to his cousin. Of course, his cousin is the most powerful man in the country, probably one of the most powerful men in the world. So of course he's going to always compare himself to that as well. But he also talks quite a bit about his lack of children, which I don't want to spoil why he doesn't have any children. It's not down to the Omega problems. And then he talks about his failed marriage, and I found all that quite interesting and quite compelling. And yet I didn't like him as a person. His motivations throughout were a little bit dodgy, even when he didn't even have any motivations all from the beginning. And then at the very end, his character, well, I must call it into question, really, because you think, oh, he's the main character, he's the good guy. And then I'm just like, but is he really the good guy? I guess he is, but his stated motivations, you can almost, like, they're almost just transparent as those of the other characters who are portrayed as the bad guys in this book. And this is the thing, the other characters in the book, there's quite a few who are very interesting and compelling. Zan, the Warden of England, is a very interesting person, because he isn't, I mean, like, in the movie, I might as well contrast it here, that in the movie, it seems like the government forces are driven by this sort of evil fascist dictatorship. And while you do have elements of that in the book, you can almost, like I said before, you can almost sort of go, oh, well, I understand what he's doing. He's wanting everyone just to get on well with each other, and everyone to be happy, and everyone to be free. I mean, there's different ways they say free of fear, free of want, free of boredom. Just let everyone get on with their life, and everyone be nice and happy and things. And you think, well, that's actually quite good. It's nothing, he's like, well, of course I'm going to become the dictator of England, because nobody else is going to run the country. I've just got to get on and do it. I mean, who else is going to do this? And the Council of England, they've all got their own, you know, ways of doing things. And you think, well, okay, some of the ways that they go about it aren't so good. But again, they're just getting on with the job, And I think this is one of the strengths of the book, is that the bad characters are written so well that they're not black, they're just shades of grey. And then the good guys are also similar shades of grey, even the ones who aren't interesting or compelling, because they're then set up to be the good guys, that sort of makes them interesting in different ways, that how completely unsuited they are to become, you know, revolutionaries, and how unsuited they are to any kind of revolutionary action. For example, there's the leader of the Fishers, Rolf. He shows off later on in the book, he shows off his real motivations. And at first I think, oh, that's no, nobody's quite like that. And then I realise nobody can be quite that unbelievable. But then I've known people very much like him. I've worked for people like him a number of times, actually. Probably twice in my life I've worked for people who are, you know, mildly sociopathic, and they don't really care about other human beings, and they only care about the mission, or they only care about the current goal, or they only care about, you know, the current state of the business. And it's quite depressing when these bad guys who show up in books and movies also turn up in my own life. You know, thankfully my own life doesn't have the same import as the characters in this book, so I can just, you know, quit those jobs or leave those jobs, or, as is always the case, be sort of forced to resign in some really weird bullshit passive-aggressive kind of things. Anyway, these kind of people do exist out there. So later on, when Theo slowly starts taking control of the Fishers, I could sort of see where things were going in the end. The good guys aren't good. The bad guys aren't bad. Like I say, there's just various shades of grey in between. Queen, and that was one of my sort of favorite sort of ideas of this book, that the people in the, like, for so long, Theo is, people are going, oh, come on, Theo, do something, and he's like, I'm not going to bother. And she makes all the characters very interesting. So this is, in some ways, a science fiction book. There's a big what-if question there. But it's not written by someone who is normally a science fiction author. I take it that P.D. James normally writes sort of like mystery novels, mystery stories. So it's, like I say, not traditional science fiction. It's, and so when it's like set, it's like I say, it's set in 1990. No, it's not set in 95. Set in 2021. So we've still got another 10 years before this book is set. And, you know, there's not a lot of technology. In fact, there's no technology even talked about. 1995, that's Omega year, no more children being born. And I was just thinking, well, where's all the sort of like medical research? And it's touched on, but in a way that, oh yeah, some countries were doing medical research and, you know, technological research into fertility. But then, you know, it's just dismissed as like a failing project. It's like, yeah, but it didn't really work out. It's just not the scope of this novel. This novel is not even slightly concerned about thinking about, okay, well, what about cloning? Wouldn't cloning be a good idea? Oh, and what about this? And what about that? And what about all these other ideas that you could, you know, that you could try to solve the problem of no children? But really, it doesn't think about that. You know, the story doesn't tell you that. It's just like, okay, the gene pool has dried up, and that's it. Now let's get on with the story that we want to tell and leave behind all kind of thoughts of new technology or new inventions. So in 2021, there's no computers, there are no mobile phones, there's no internet, there's nothing like that, which I found quite refreshing in a way. It really has the same feel as like the 1950s kind of apocalyptic, post-apocalyptic books, say John Wyndham, like Day of the Triffids, and everyone is just very sort of middle class and very just getting on with it. At least the idea being it's like a cozy apocalypse, like of John Wyndham's and things like that. So yeah, people are just like or a bit like H.G. Wells as well. It's sort of like, okay, well, I went out to Oxford and I did this, and then I went to this little town and things. There is actually one technological idea which was brought up, and it sort of stood out as being the only kind of prediction of technology in the future. And that it was spot on, because P.D. James, she goes, okay, and they were watching Neighbours, which was resampled for the new high-definition televisions. And it just says, oh yeah, and now everyone needs a high-definition television. I was like, yeah, that's spot on. Now people do have high-definition television. So I like it that the only one positive, like one proactive technological invention that she puts in place for, 30 years after this book was written was high definition TV, and she hits it dead on. But it's quite strange that this book could have been written in 1971 and set in 1995, and it would have been exactly the same story with exactly the same things. They get in their car and they go out driving, and people are leaving notes to each other rather than emailing or doing text messages. And so it sort of takes on a timeless quality when predictions of future technology are left out. It hasn't dated very much. I mean, the only reason why it feels dated is because current technology doesn't exist, rather than it feels dated because the predictions of the future are way off, which often happens in books like this. So the rest of like the science fictional elements is very much sort of like the soft science, the social science, the ideas of what's going on, and thematic explorations of what society is like when no children are born for 25 years. I'll get into more of that later. The writing is, it switches, really. It switches between part diary, so it's part in first person, and part third person, and so it's, the switching is like, whenever it's like first person, it's all about memories and sort of like local action to Theo, who's writing this diary, and the third person parts of the book is very much the action parts. Well, not so much action. Well, there is a bit of action, but it switches, and you get a little bit more of the sort of wider view of the story. And there's different kind of explanation, different kind of backstory within both styles of writing. The diary is a little bit more dry, but you can see that Theo is sort of showing off with the language, and it's more personal. And then the third person narrative has, you know, different kind of colourful language because it's slightly of a different view. I actually made notes of a few things early on in the book because I mentioned before in some of the books, with other audiobooks, I really enjoy the turns of phrase, the little writing ideas, the little, you know, analogies, the little metaphors that are brought up. And I always think that's really good. But then because it's an audiobook, it's very difficult just to make a note of it, just to turn the corner of the page over, or on an ebook, just say, mark this and then go back and read it. So I copied down two of the little things that stood out for me as some of the nicer writing. Talking about Zan and about how he hasn't got married, his cousin writes, Theo writes, "It would take a force more powerful than sexual love to prize open the portcullis which defends that crenellated heart and mind." And I quite like that idea there, because this guy is a powerful man. He's the warden of England in his castle, and then I don't need to break it down. It stands for itself. Another thing, when he's talking about his failed marriage, he goes, "We might have salvaged something from the wreckage of a marriage that from the start hadn't been particularly seaworthy." And this is really interesting because, you know, the wreckage of a marriage that from the start hadn't been particularly seaworthy. Later on, he goes to witness one of the quietus ceremonies. And the ceremony is pretty much they put people in a boat, tug them out to sea, and then shoot a hole in the bottom of the boat and let it sink. And all the people who are in the boat, all the old people in the boat, sink down to the bottom. So I really like the continuing idea of the fortress Britain with Zan, and how he is like set up as like a castle in his heart, as a castle. And then also the wreckage of the marriage, you know, the seaworthy marriage. And then you find out that the way that humans are killed, you know, this voluntary euthanasia is by sinking boats, and that's what he writes, or that's what P.D. James writes, that Theo writes about his own marriage. And so that kind of play with the language is all the way through the book. There's probably many, many layers of metaphor here, and with the writing that I'm missing. But what is there? There's loads of different like references back to the story within the writing, and back to the themes within the writing. The narration by Julian Glover, he has a very staid English accent, and it's perfect for the character. He talks like an Oxford Don, and so pretty good narration. No complaints there at all. Like I say, there's a few things that he pronounces which I thought would have been pronounced differently, like the whole idea of the quietus. He calls it quietus, and I guess that's probably the right pronunciation, but when I saw it in the movie, I think that you just see it in it. I don't think they actually say quietus. They just say that you just see that the packaging for a little suicide injection thing, and it's called quietus rather than quietus. But you know, otherwise no problems there at all. So getting on finally to the themes of the book, there's quite a lot of stuff going on here. I might as well talk a little bit about what I said before. Freedom from fear, freedom from want, freedom from boredom. That is what the council and Zan says, the warden says. And they're noble goals. Yeah, I mean, who doesn't want freedom from fear and freedom from want and freedom from boredom? If you did, you'd be living in a utopian society. And I guess that's what they're aiming for. They are aiming for a weird kind of utopia. So one of the main themes is the willing submission of the population to a dictatorship in the name of a utopia. And I think that's one of the compelling cases to be made here. Not that I think it's a good idea, of course. I don't think people should willingly submit to any kind of dictatorship. But I see what P.D. James is doing here, what she's portraying is totally understandable, because what if there was no future? What if there was no children to think of, or, you know, no posterity to consider either? You know, it's a perfect system, you know, for self-interest, or to encourage self-interest. You know, one of the main driving forces is the continuation of life. By life, you know, that's one of the main forces in life. And then I guess one of the main forces of society is the continuation of that society. But what if the society demonstrably has no future at all? You know, the status quo is doing everyone just fine. So why bother voting? Or why bother, you know, joining a jury? Or why bother taking part in local politics? Why bother looking after criminals? You know, apathy in this way is a powerful force. So they kind of giving up, you know, let me put it this way, to challenge the system, you have to give up comfort. And when the whole idea of the system is to provide comfort, it sort of encourages people not to take part in anything. And why should people take part? Because all they want is not to be bored and just to live out their life and approach death and, you know, see the future, even though there is no future. So that's one of the Five Fishes' main challenges. And that's one of Theo's main challenges, because, like, who will step forward? Of course, nobody's going to step forward. You know, at one point they say, well, the Isle of Wight needs a governor. This Isle of Wight penal colony, it needs a governor. Who's going to volunteer for that? Who's going to spend the rest of the, you know, live out the rest of humanity's existence just being a prison guard or a prison warden? Why should anyone have to do that? You know, the people who want to be, you know, in the military, or the people who want to be policemen, well, of course we can just, the people who want to do that, that's fine, but nobody should have to do what they don't want to do. And if they do, well, you know, let's get the sojourners, let's get the foreigners to come in and do that kind of stuff. And it's very appealing. And the jurors need filling. Okay, who's going to step forward? Who's going to be on a jury? And of course nobody's going to do that. And so what happens is the Five Fishes, they're only five people, but what can they do? And of course they can't just volunteer to do that. They got to sort of overcome the apathy of the country. And I'm thinking, well, all we left with is, like, all it takes for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. Whereas in this case, evil doesn't even have to triumph. All it needs to do is be slightly less uninterested than the good. Either side could do nothing and, you know, everyone will just get on with it. But it's not even like, it's not even evil that's triumphing. It's like boredom that's triumphing, or like the fight against boredom. It's just sort of like the slow decline is the thing that's triumphing. So, and good takes work. And even in this book, we learn that, you know, the motives behind the good are almost identical to the motives behind the evil. You know, and that brings me again back to Theo. It's like, is he a good man who's doing nothing that lets evil triumph? And in a way, no. Because he's not even a good man. He's completely nihilistic. And it's like he doesn't, and then when he doesn't do nothing, he tries to do something, but it's like almost half-hearted. And then he just goes on holiday, just goes on vacation. It's just like, oh, well, you know, it just turns out that, oh, just going on vacation, that's more important than the suffering of the world or the suffering of the country. And it really sort of gets to me, and I'm like, wow, this is very depressing in a way. It's like, is there good in the world? Of course there's good in the world, but I always think, well, you know, what do? I could spend all my money and all my effort, you know, helping those in need. But, you know, I often just go on holiday. I often just go on vacation. I do spend part of my time and part of my money helping other people, you know, not always in a charity kind of way. But, you know, I do help other people. I volunteer doing different things. And, you know, but it's a bit strange. But you just go, oh, yeah, I guess we all just want to go on holiday. We all just want to go on vacation. We all just want to hang out and have that freedom from fear and freedom from want and freedom from boredom. That's the reason why you're listening to this podcast, is because, you know, you just want to take your mind off something. You just want to hang out, read a book. There's loads of things that we can do. But I guess in some way, we're all a bit nihilistic. The youngest man on Earth was killed in a bar fight. And you just go, oh, well, that's a pity. Well, I guess we've got to get on with the end of the world. And yeah, so it's the whole book is quite strange, that it's totally understandable why people just go, look, Warden of England, just get on with it. Just make my life comfortable and we'll get on with it here. So it's a very powerful exploration of that. Another prominent theme of this book is the religion. There's quite a few passages where they talk about religion and they meet in churches, and, you know, the book ends with a religious ceremony and all. There's lots of different mentions. There's lots of talk about the Christian TV preachers, not all of them Christian. Oh, they all started off as Christian, but because it's the end of the world and there's no more children anymore, lots of people are take this in different directions. Some people are saying, yes, this is the end of the world that's laid out in Revelation, but it's not everyone, it hasn't been taken up to heaven for the end of the world in some kind of rapture, some Harold Camping style, 21st of April or May or whatever it was kind of rapture. It's a little bit more subtle. We're all just disappearing one by one. God is taking us up to heaven one by one. So all of the churches break apart into different kind of twisted Christianity cult like kind of things. The fishes, or the five fishes, are in part motivated by religion, or some of them are. But one thing that I could tie this back to, is which I think is very interesting, is the last book that I reviewed, which is called Surface Detail by Ian M. Banks, and that was talking about hell, and which is a very different kind of post-apocalyptic kind of book, or apocalyptic kind of idea there. And in that book, one of the main themes of hell is that the only thing, the one thing that you need to create a hell is to make people really, really suffer, is for there to be hope of something, and then that hope is not being fulfilled. And there's quite long passages in that book where they're trying to get this one female alien character to feel hope, and then when they take it away again, everything will be even more damaging to her psychologically and emotionally. And the one thing that she doesn't do ever is find hope, and they can't break her, they can't make her hope for anything. So in the end, the kind of wardens of hell make her the hope of other people. She becomes like an angel of hope within hell, even though she can only give hope and to a few people in hell, or a few of the souls in hell. Most of them just see the hope and then realize that they can never attain that hope. And here in The Children of Men, I think that's what religion gives people. It gives people some kind of hope. It makes it a little bit more bearable. But in the same way, that the only thing, the only way that you can, have this hold over people is to make them feel worse than they do. That's what hope is, sorry. So the role of religion in this book is to, or the way that it's set up, I'm not saying the role of religion in a society, but within the book, it seems that the way to make the society more dystopian is to show people in a completely hopeless situation, put their hope into something which is hopeless, which is these new ideas of religion. They could be putting their hope into the different science, or they could be putting their hope in the different things, or in different I don't know. It's really strange how some guys, they're what they call it, laying down wine. They're creating wine. They're creating vintages of wine, which will become good in 50 years' time. But of course, in 50 years' time, there'll be nobody left to drink the wine. And I found that kind of like just getting on with life, and that kind of hope, to be even more poignant than the religious. But I don't, maybe I've lost track of what I'm trying to say here. But the idea of different hope in a hopeless situation makes the hopeless situation feel almost more hopeless for me as a reader, and makes the book even more grim. Even more grim? Grimmer. Grimmerer. I don't know. And finally, I just want to talk a little bit about affection towards children. And you see that quite a lot in the book. In this book, there's a lot of people displaying affection towards their children and love towards their children and making their children feel good, except, of course, there's no children. So that makes me think, is affection towards children for the parent, or is it for the children? And of course it's for the parent. And this novel states quite explicitly that it's for the parent. You know, children, I guess young children, don't even know that they are loved. They don't know if they are loved, and that's what we get quite explicitly with Theo's experience with children. I don't want to give too much away, but, well, let me put it this way. He had a child, and he, of course, didn't love his child, but his child obviously thought that he was loved by both his mother and his father, and of course he didn't. So you've got a man who couldn't show affection towards his child, and then once there are no children anymore, all of the people, like the women, have dolls, and they have cats, and they have small dogs as well, anything that's about the right size and about the right temperament to, set your affection towards them, rest your affections on these things, on these, non-children entities that stand in for surrogates of children. There's these religious ceremonies where they christen dolls and they christen kittens, and they have birthing ceremonies where people can go along and see the kittens give birth and things. And you just realize, wow, this really, the way that people look after their children, it's it's so much not for the children. Of course it is for the children, because biologically we're programmed to do all this kind of thing. Evolution has said, okay, the children stand in and they have to have lots of affection from the parents. And of course this is what, you know, whole of society is built around, and all childbirth is built around. But it makes it pretty much the most depressing part of the book for me. Out of the passage, it starts off in this way, you know, it starts off with someone who has a child, and another woman picks up this child and smashes the head against the wall and, you know, kills the child. Because it's not a child, it's a doll. And they're trying to say, look, stop being an idiot like this. It's just a doll, it's not a real child. And they really illustrate that the world without children is so scary in its own way. But it doesn't just... These passages don't even illustrate a world without children. They illustrate our world now with children, and it kind of makes me scared to be a parent. Well, not scared to be a parent, but, you know, it makes me like cautious of the different things that parents do, and that it's the most of the things that parents do for their children isn't for the children, it's for themselves. I know this is quite again like depressing or nihilistic or reductionist, but I do think that is one of the main themes within the book, is like what we do for other people isn't really for other people, especially when it comes to children, because to be honest, they probably don't understand what we're doing for them. They don't understand that we love them, if we love them, if we don't love them or anything like that. They're like a dog. You know, cats just get on with life. Dogs are like, oh, you love me, everyone loves me, I'm gonna get food, yeah, I'm gonna walk around, you know, and they're all just like, all the time, just, you know, lavishing affection on the owners, not knowing if the owner loves them or not. You beat the dog, you keep beating the dog, you keep beating the dog, and it comes back for another beating because it thinks that is the sign of affection. I don't want to talk like that you should beat children or beat dogs or anything. I'm just saying that's the level of emotional maturity that you get in dogs, but you also have it in children, and this book pretty much shows that you also get that same level of emotional maturity in adults too. And like I say, very, very depressing to read this. So I guess that'll bring me to the end of the routine. It's not a great book. It is a good book. I think it gives you more to think about when you're not reading it, or when you're reading it, then you do have to enjoy reading it, like plot-wise. I think it's too slow in places, but the slow parts do give you a lot to think about. Some of the character changes in the book I don't think are worked out properly, but again, that adds to like the nihilistic, apocalyptic story. The thing is, let me put it this way, most post-apocalyptic books, they're too easy. You just go, oh, everyone's killing each other, that's really bad, oh, you know, or maybe like the totalitarian books, like 1984, it's almost too easy. Of course it's a totalitarian government, of course it's, you know, a dictatorship, of course it's really bad, you know, because of course it is, it's really bad, it's a really bad situation. After a nuclear war, of course it's bad. After a meteor strikes the world, of course it's bad. After the whole world keeps dying out, of course it's bad. Whereas in here, on the surface of it, it's very well written, as in that, well, it's not too bad, is it? But then, like you say, there's all these layers to it which make it feel even worse. This addition of religion as hope that slowly drains away, the apathy of the people to the dictatorship, you know, the emotional immaturity of everyone there for everyone else to see, that kind of thing makes it more dystopian. That's what I'm trying to say. It's more dystopian for being less dystopian societally and more dystopian, you know, emotionally and intellectually. And yeah, I think that's quite a challenge of the book that it sets forth, and something which I haven't really seen so much in dystopian or apocalyptic or it's not really post-apocalyptic, because the apocalypse is in progress, so mid-apocalyptic kind of books that we get here. But it, like I say, there is it is a bit slow, and I do think the story and some of the characters are a little bit lacking to cause me interest. So I'm only going to give it 3.5 stars. It could have been a 4 or 5 star book, but there's just it falls short on just a few too many points. Oh yeah, and a little bit about the movie. I might as well say that this is one of those rare cases where the movie is a better movie than the book is a good book. Oh, let me put it this way. They've got such different tones, it's hard to compare them side by side. And of course, they're different kinds of media. A book is a book, and a movie is a movie. And I don't like comparing them. And of course, the movie, exists independently of the book, and the book still exists independently of the movie. But I do think, you know, like, let me put it this way, the movie lacks certain things that the book provides, which is like backstory and development of characters and like a sense of the world emptying, the population diminishing and things like that. You don't get that in the movie. And then the movie gives you sort of like action and likable characters. You know, there's some really nice character interactions between people, and you sort of see affection for each other on a more adult level. And you get these like visual treats, and it's a great movie going experience as well, like that. And a lot of that stuff is missing from the book. But I do think, I wouldn't say objectively, but subjectively, in my opinion, I think the movie is a better movie than the book is a good book. But again, that's a normal point. Oh, let me just quickly check this out. Oh, yeah, I made another note here. Normally, it's the other way around, isn't it? The books are normally better books than movies, based on the books of movies. But except, of course, Carl Sagan's Contact is totally, utterly, well, I didn't finish it. I didn't manage to finish it because I thought the book was so badly written and the story and characters are so badly done. The movie is superior in almost every way, you know, the movie with Jodie Foster. But it's only an average movie, but that's because the book is so bad that just a merely average movie can beat it. Whereas I think the movie The Children of Men was one of my favourite movies, like my favourite science fiction movies of recent years. So let me quickly check out goodreads.com because I've got that webpage open here. Let's check out what other people say. I gave it 3.5 stars. Goodreads.com gives it 3.52 stars, which is pretty good. And Friends Review, 16 people who reviewed it, and are friends of mine, listeners to the SFBIP, I guess, 3.22 average. So I guess we're all in broad agreement between just around about 3 to 4 stars. Tom Rowe said, save your time, watch the movie. It has more depth and I felt more real than this book. It's actually an inversion of how I often feel about movies and books. Yeah, well, Tom Rowe, he still gives it 3 stars. Jason rated it 3 stars. Dominique rated it 3 stars. Brian rated it 1 star. Julie Davis rated it 5 stars. Michael, 3 stars. Sandy rated it 4 stars. She said, I love the movie based on the book. This was one of the best from last year. When the book came up on Amazon recommendation, I thought I'd give it a read. Children of Men is a very thoughtful and thought-provoking book. I'm not going to say any more. I don't want to give anything away. Well, thank you very much, Sandy. And a few people rated it. Greg rated it 3 out of 5 as well. So, yeah, pretty much the same kind of take on it. It is worth reading. It's worth reading completely independently of the movie. But it is very slow. If you don't want thoughtful examinations of different societal topics and of loss and death and all that kind of stuff. Hey, I've gone on way too long here. 52 minutes going on this podcast already. So, that's it. Email me, luke@juggler.net. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm @LukeBurge on there too. Best thing to do, though, is get on goodreads.com. If you want to recommend a book, do it via there. It makes it very easy for me to add it to my to-read list, goodreads.com/LukeBurge. Add me as a friend or follow my reviews or do whatever you need to do on there. I update all the books that I'm reading as I'm reading. The next book that I'm going to review, well, I've got some audiobooks. I decided to give Solaris by Stanislav Lem a read. I've got that on my iPod. I've not started listening to it yet. And I've got R. Scott Backer's The Judging Eye, book one of the Aspect Emperor series. It's a fantasy book that I'm about halfway through. What's that? Yeah, 278 pages into that one. About halfway through. So one of those books will be coming up soon too. Yeah, so goodreads.com is a way to keep track of what I'm reading and suggest books to me. Otherwise, check out my website, lukeburge.com/creative for my other podcast project at the moment, /blog for my blog where I'm sharing lots of movies and music and photography and all my juggling stories and things like that. Otherwise, that's it. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.